The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and a warm welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia El-Khoury and tonight I'm delighted to be joined by June O'Sullivan. Now, June is the CEO of LEAF, which is the London Early Years Foundation, and it is the largest childcare social enterprise in the UK, no less. Hi June, thanks a million for joining us on The Parents Show this evening.
Hi, thank you, Lydia. I look forward to having a chat.
Yes, indeed. We love picking your brain, June. And there's so many things we can talk to you, but today we're just going to dial down on children in and around two. But before we do that, I want to ask you, can you remind our listeners, in case they missed any of our previous conversations, remind us about what exactly LEAF does, the London Early Years Foundation does, and your mission here in the UK?
So LEAF is a group of 41 nurseries, soon to be 43, and we look after and educate 4,000 children, you know, every day, give or take. We employ about 1,000 staff, just under 1,000 staff, and that includes also training up 60 to 100 apprentices at any one time. So we're quite a big employer in the childcare sector, and we're based only in London. So there's 13 boroughs that we operate in, but it's only in London. Because we're a social enterprise, what we tend to do is we cross-subsidise so that children from the more disadvantaged communities and the poorer neighbourhoods can access nurseries. So we have 75% of our nurseries are based in those areas because so many children are excluded from really high-quality nurseries. And that's something we think is very important for children. And our children start with us usually about 6 months, but sometimes parents are under a pressure to go back to work sooner. And so sometimes we have little babies of 4 months old and they tend to stay with us till they're four-ish and then they're sent to the primary school.
That's brilliant. What a huge foundation. That's a lot of children. That's a lot of employees, a lot of responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah. But working with children is, you know, the greatest gift that anyone could have. And so I've been working with them for directly probably over 20 years and indirectly probably 30 years. So I think we recognize the importance of children and the fact that they are the most joyful and curious and engaging characters you could possibly hope to meet.
Indeed. I'd say there's a lot of parents nodding, but also thinking challenging maybe as well.
True. So I know you want us to talk about the two-year-olds, Lydia.
Yeah.
Two-year-olds, I rather like two-year-olds but they do get a very bad press. Two-year-olds are often associated with, you know, tempers and tantrums and being difficult, being hard to manage. But often I think it's because we come at it from the wrong way. But a two-year-old is just developing their independence. So they've just moved out of that babyhood of under twos, and they're trying to figure out how to speak, how to walk independently, and how to navigate a sort of social space. So they're beginning to move away from their parents a bit, not far, but away. And so they are wanting to be able to kind of navigate into this wider social space. And so two things tend to respond. They're very emotional. So they respond with great passion, a real fire. And secondly, they are really trying to manage themselves. There's a word that is used a lot these days, but what it really means is the same thing, which is regulate the behavior. You hear that a lot. And what really that is how do we teach these little children to manage the large amount of emotions that explode and erupt in their tiny little bodies? And part of that, and why two-year-olds particularly kind of associated with that, is because they're also learning to speak. And so they're often very frustrated that what's in their heads, they can't get out fast enough. And so you can feel them getting cross because they can't tell you and you don't necessarily understand what they're trying to translate. And so you're trying to figure it all out with them. And if you're their parent, you kind of know your children pretty well, so you probably can read the signs. But if you're not there, or they're outside, or they're in the supermarket, or in those places where people are looking at them, and the environment can sometimes be hugely overwhelming, they often lose it a bit in those environments. And they don't know how to regulate. So they have what is, you know, known to every parent in the land, is they have a meltdown or a tantrum. and you kind of don't know what to do, because partly you're trying to respond not to the child, but to everyone looking at you. And partly as they decide to have it in the most awkward place. So you're trying to move them out of the way so they're not in the way of someone else. But you're also trying to realize that in your head, your logical bit of your brain is saying to you, they got to sort of let this burn out a little bit. I've got to give them a little bit of space just to work through this. But oh my gosh, I can't, because they're in the middle of the trolley aisle. You know, so I think there are those kind of dilemmas. And of course, in a nursery, the staff, the nursery teachers are all so very comfortable with this and so very aware of this. They kind of figure out how to handle this and they create the sort of safe space. So when the child is throwing themselves around or, you know, trying to kind of get some control over their fizzing brain, the staff kind of can create a much safer space very quickly for the child, which makes it much easier, I suppose, for anyone dealing with that. You know, I have great sympathy with the 2-year-olds, and I certainly have great sympathy with parents or grandparents or whoever is in charge of a 2-year-old when they kind of lose their moment.
Absolutely. God, you describe it beautifully. And there is so much stigma attached to it. You know, invariably, it'll be in the middle of a supermarket or a library or somewhere where you really, really, really don't need the meltdown. Yeah. But that's when it happens. Yeah. But thanks for explaining what's going on in their kind of physiological kind of development.
Yes, they are. I mean, their brains, the synaptic connections in their brains is really powerful. And like most of their brain grows between the time they're 0 and 5. So, you know, growing your brain is also quite tiring. So they do get quite tired and they can't manage that tiredness. So sometimes parents think that they want to keep them up because then they sleep at night. Actually, that's really not sensible, because if they have a short nap, then the quality of their day is better and then the quality of their sleep is better in the evening. So I totally get when you've got this child running riot, you know, at 8:30 at night and you're exhausted yourself and you've got to prepare packed lunches for tomorrow and you've got to do this, that and the other. And all you want them to do is go to bed. But, you know, every time you put them down, they're up again or they're calling for water or they're calling for something. And it's very hard to ignore them because they're there in your head like a little buzzy bee. So I think that is also a factor. It's just kind of understanding how the 2-year-old is kind of made, you know, how their body is beginning to function. And I think that's really helpful. And sometimes when you bring your 2-year-old to nursery, you kind of learn that better because you've got somebody else who's taking an equal interest in your child and who's kind of in a way narrating for you what's happening in the day. A, if it's your first child, it gives you confidence that you're not a completely mad parent and that you must have the worst child in the world. And B, it kind of gives you a reason for why you think about why maybe a 2-year-old will actually do okay in the nursery once they've been settled well and you're settled well as well. So they're not picking up your anxiety and you're not just running in and dumping them because you've suddenly gone back to work and, you know, the pressures are all over you, like, you know, and you're just like a bouncing ball trying to meet everybody's needs except your own.
You've described it beautifully. And I love what you said about fizzing. Their brain is fizzing, basically. And that's actually what it looks like. It looks like their brains are fizzing. And you touched on something really important there, that magic word, sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know I kind of fell into that trap of thinking I'll get more out of them if I let them stay up a little bit later. But it's counterintuitive, but sleep gets sleep, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And sleep is actually part of a healing process. Now, I know a lot of 2-year-olds take some time to get down. And I had one myself where in the end, I gave up all hope, you know, and I created a nest for him in my bedroom. But sleep is hugely routine. So it's about order and it's about sticking to the knitting. So nobody wants to leave a child crying, their little hearts crying and, you know, a little tucked in themselves because, you know, you're saying you've got to go to sleep. So you have to really think about your child in the sleep way. And I know it's a big problem for many parents. It's like they won't go to sleep. And there's many books written about particular techniques. You know, I think really is you, first of all, you get to know your child. So like, what is the kind of a time where they seem ready to be in the bed? They seem ready to be settled down. So often when you're in a very busy, the routine at the end of the day gets lost. But actually the routine at the end of the day for a 2-year-old is very important. The come on in, we're going to have a bath or wash, whatever it is. We've had our dinner, you know, we've had the story. We're settled down. Now we're going upstairs to bed. Now you're going to put your pajamas on. We're, you know, every day the same kind of thing, the same order, and the cleaning of the teeth and the whole thing, and then the settling into bed. And then they start the, oh, I just want this. Oh, don't go, mummy. Oh, you know, I'm not another story, mummy. Or, you know, I'm not tired, mummy. You know, the usual. And that goes on, and it depends on their level of articulation. A tiny new two-year-old is going to be much less able to kind of say the words, and more often it's single words and they're kind of hanging on to you. By the time they're towards the end of two, they're pretty articulate. They're telling you what they want and what they don't want. And you're like negotiating. But there's always a point of negotiation when you have to stop and you have to say, no, this is the bedtime. But you kind of have to rule out all the kind of hygiene factors. You know, is it too hot? Is it too cold? Is it too dark? Is it too light? You know, are they comfortable? Have they got their blankie or their, you know, their little rabbit or whatever it is they have into bed? And, you know, are they better if you leave the door ajar? You know, are they better having one of those lights plugged into the wall? All of those things are very important. And, you know, these are also important when you settle them into a nursery, because in a way you want them get up in the morning and ready and excited to be going and, you know, and everything is going through and they're having their breakfast. Although they can, of course, have their breakfast at the nursery. That's not the end of the world. But, you know, it's those kind of things. So that's happening. And parents get so worked up about this sleep thing because they are exhausted. But actually, sleep is best done through routine. And I know it sounds trite, and I really don't want it to, but it is really about order, hygiene factors, and routine. Order, hygiene. And even though you might have to lie on the bed for ages, you know, you have to keep going, you have to keep this going and stuff like that. It's one of the things we often say to parents when you're getting them ready for nursery, especially if we're having babies coming to nursery, is get them used to noise, get them used to things that are can disturb them, get them used to things that are unsettling, get them used to things that are kind of different so that they're not fearful of these things. They're not bothered by these things. Or when they arrive, they're kind of, they've seen it before, or they understand it. And that's the same, I think, whether your babies are 2-year-olds, it's the same kind of thing. So when you're preparing them for nursery, you know, kind of prepare them for, you know, the unexpected and the unknown. Be prepared to the fact that they'll get tired quite often. So be ready to have them settled into the bed. And when they're trying it on with you and stuff, talk to the nursery staff. Don't be ashamed and thinking, oh, I must be a terrible parent. Because we carry a lot of judginess about us these days. But actually, you know, the nurseries are often that step away. So they love your child too. They love them. They're so delightful. You love them. But you haven't got that emotional bond quite in the same level. So you're very fond of them and you love them coming and you love to hold them and hug them and they love to see you. But that hugely emotional bond that nobody can understand. It's just between a parent and a child. It's so overwhelming that sometimes it's just very hard to step away from it. And the nursery staff, especially if it's a good nursery, a warm nursery, an experienced nursery, then they will be really helpful to you about the sleep pattern. And they'll also do stories about going to sleep, now sleep now. And all those very popular stories that prepare the children for understanding that there is a point in the day and in the evening when there's an expectation that their eyes close and they don't open again for a goodly sum of time, you know.
Yeah, and it's good and it's healthy and it's normal and it has to happen.
And it has to happen. It so has to happen. Yeah.
But it's the other thing I think that nurseries and are great at doing when it comes to supporting parents is reminding them that it's okay to say no. It's actually, you know, putting
better
those,
to say no.
Yeah, to put those boundaries.
We see far too much negotiation with small children. And while, of course, you don't want to be sort of brutal, but they do need to know there's a fine line in the sand and they're much more secure as a consequence of it. Like they really are. And they like, because there's boundaries and every child needs a set of boundaries that they feel they have something to fight against. Where you see difficulties is where there's no boundaries and they don't know really how to, they don't know how to regulate and they don't know, you don't know how to co-regulate with them. And that's a very scary space for a child who doesn't feel that the adult is in charge. And they need to know that the adult is in charge.
Absolutely. I mean, boundaries are there for kids to just find out where the line is.
Yeah.
You know, they need to know there's a line.
They
where
do,
it is,
and know, that the adult is in charge, and that doesn't make you a bad parent or a cruel parent. But there are now very many modern sort of parenting types of gentle parenting, and we hear this a lot, you know. And we would never tell them off, and we never say no, and we let them try everything. And And you just think, okay, well, if you want to be at the beck and call of this child 24 hours a day, then go ahead. But also the children do need to say no, because they're going to hear no from their friends, and they're going to hear no from other people who are simply going to say no, not now. Or, you know, no doesn't have to be like some kind of, you know, crushing experience.
Yeah.
No is a fair, is one of, it's in the lexicon because it has a purpose. So when you say no, we'll do this later, or no, not now, or no, that's not very kind, or no, do you really want to do that now? I don't think so. No, no, not now. You know, they get it. And so, and they soon learn to kind of emulate that. So then they'll say this to their friends. No, I don't like it. Or, you know, no, no, you can't do that now. We're going to have lunch or whatever, you know, but they soon learn those things. And so no is a negotiated concept as much as it is a very firm concept. So when you have parents coming in at 6 o'clock and they don't want to put their coats on and they don't want to go home, they want to put their shoes on, and the poor parent sitting there negotiating, but we'll do this and what about that and how do you feel about that? And that often, you know, you start with that intention. I'm not saying you should be jumping and, you know, saying no straight off, but as soon as you realize there's a line is starting to form, you have to then say, I'm sorry, but I need to go now. You know, we have to catch the bus, or I have to go home, or daddy's going to be home for his dinner, or I don't know, whatever it is, you know, but that there's a reality that they have to understand. And children have to understand this from the time they're really very little, that they are one of a group. And so they have to wait their turn, and they have to understand they're part of a group. So the world doesn't revolve entirely around them, because it doesn't make them nice children.
It doesn't make them nice children. And it actually doesn't make them likable adults.
No.
Nobody can sustain that level of kind of adoration and best friendism that some parents, I think, feel that it's their role to play now. But of course, it's not your job to be your child's best friend. It's your job to be a guide, a role model, and
a partner in your learning, and a supporter, and a fan, a great fan, and a great help. But in the end, there's a boundary to be had, and you're the grown up and they're the child, and that's the rule of the road, you know, that's the game. And so they soon, and children really understand that, but they will test this to the nth degree. So the more you let them unravel it, the more they'll take you to the next level. And I, you know, there's a very interesting situation for me. I mean, I really like children, and I really like to watch the way they grow and the way they navigate things and the way they philosophize and stuff. But what's been very interesting to me, and I know we won't be talking about it much today, but it's one for the future, is how has child rearing turned into the art and science of parenting? What language changed? Because in changing that language from just rearing your child, which I always feel I reared my children, and my mother reared her children, and your generations past reared the children, this notion of parenting has now almost created some kind of weird science around it. And I think with it has come quite a lot of anxiety, actually, and quite a lot of lack of confidence, where people begin to think they're parenting, to parent as a verb, you know, the art science of parenting. I just think that's quite a interesting sort of creation of modern society. But I'm not entirely sure it always is helpful when you're trying to manage your two-year-old and understand how they're developing.
And indeed, it brings along a lot of opportunity for judgment and recrimination, because there's so much pressure on it.
But and social media not helping at all. Everybody kind of hails you out and is very quick to judge. And I think God, there, but for the grace of God goes any of us, you know.
But yes, let's put a pin in that, June. Let's talk about the science of parenting and another podcast and another day. But for today, I'm getting a clear idea of what a nearly two-year-old needs in terms of sleep, boundaries, experience. Now, if we're to talk, I'd love to take it into the context of preschool and nursery. Can you help us, those of us who don't know the difference? Is there a difference, and what is it?
No, not really. A preschool or a nursery is an environment, a setting. It's often called a setting these days because they have slightly different names, where children attend for a fixed hour and they have they work under an Ofsted regulated environment where we have certain ratios we need to operate. The operating ratios for two-year-olds is 1 to 5 technically, but quite a lot of us operate at 1 to 4. And the 1 to 5 was introduced to reduce the costs of staffing. But I don't think it's the wisest move. But, you know, in many parts of the world, it's commonplace, including Scotland. And so it's either it's 1 to 5. And that means that for every 5 toddlers, there will be 1 qualified member of staff or 1 assistant member of staff. But every room will have a lead person who's in charge. And the better the quality of staff and the better the ratios and the more trained and experienced the staff member, the better the experience the children will get. And I would really like to push that argument that, you know, don't cut corners because it might be slightly cheaper or because, you know, you don't understand. You want as many trained staff looking after your children as possible.
Lovely and clear. Thanks a million, June. And as a result, is there a different offering or is it the same offering?
Well, I mean... Really, it's a really tough call for parents because the government is now extending the offer from 15 hours to 30 hours. They use the language of free, which is unhelpful because it's not free, it's funded. But they have put some rules around the funded hours so that any provider has to be very clear as to how they're charging against those rates. And then they can decide how they navigate that themselves for things like meals and, you know, what they offer. So effectively, a parent can access that offer for 30 hours a week, which is often what they call stretched. So it's 22 hours over the 52 weeks of the year or 30 hours over the 39 hours of the year. And so in the day in the life of a two-year-old arriving then would be that they generally come again about 5 hours a day. So 10 to 5, 8 to 4. It depends. Every nursery will be different and it will depend on the parents' needs. So effectively, the government's policy was to support parents to work. So therefore, one would assume they're going to be in at 8. Now, in many nurseries, you arrive and there will be a breakfast and the children will be settled at that point. And it's usually milk or water. We very rarely, and certainly any leaf nursery, would never use juice because there's too much sugar in the juice and stuff. So we've always gone for milk or organic full fat milk or water. But nowadays, of course, some children have got allergies, not uncommon. So they might well need alternative, you know. So we often provide oat milk as well as the option for children. And then, you know, they arrive for their breakfast, they've taken their coat and hat and, you know, hats off, and they've sort of put their bag on their peg, and then they come all sort of set up for the day. Now, quite often what you find is that the children of different ages are in different rooms. So your two-year-olds are probably in a room together. Now, it doesn't mean they're there all day, but that's where they settle. And often that's where they leave in the evening, because I think staff find it settling for children to be together at the end of the day and the beginning of the day as at their group. But throughout the day, they may go to other rooms, you know, sensory room. They may go to the art room. They go outside. They may go for a walk. They go to the shops. They could go any which way, depending. So if you're a parent, you might want, there's two things you can be troubled by. One, you turn up at a nursery and it looks a little bit shabby outside. Don't be put off by that. It often means that they may not have had money for spending on painting, but actually all their money is spent on the experience of the staff. So they've got really good quality staff and the children have a fantastically warm, nurturing, engaged experience. Some of them will do 1 to 4, which is again even better because that's only 4 two-year-olds to one member of staff. Some nurseries will look like something out of a hotel. They look all glitzy. They probably charge a bit more. They probably give you a cup of coffee in the morning. The question you have to ask yourself is, what's the experience for the child? What does it feel like to be a child in this setting? Does it look marvelous, but actually it's not dull? The staff are quite inexperienced. The order is very routine. There's no excitement. There's no like going out to the cafes and stuff. So really, you have to compare sometimes what it is like the kind of magic of the outside with the experience of the inside. And that's a trick for parents if you don't know, because you go in and you see what you see and you think this looks great, but you don't know what you're asking. So you're really wanting to understand the educational experience for the child in the day. It's kind of and it's led by the pedagogy. The pedagogy is how you lead the children to learn. So how do those staff lead the children to learn? What are they doing that's interesting? You know, is your child, when you come home, is it all seem very calm when you collect them and like everything seems to be put away and they're all kind of in a corner? Or are they still having play experiences? Are they still sitting with books? Is there a lot of interaction with their teachers? Have they been outside? Are they a bit muddy? Does it look like they've had fun? And do they come to you and you can read your own child's face and you can see that they've had a jolly day of excitement and interest and they've allowed to explore and experiment? This is very important for two-year-olds. Two-year-olds need a lot of that because they're still quite sensual in the way they learn. So still using their five senses. They're still very much getting into it, getting to explore it. But then they also need to have a little break from other children because it's quite intense when you're two, trying to navigate your relationships with other children. So you're learning to play and you're often parallel playing. So you're playing alongside, but not together because you're watching your friends and how they learn. And so that's really important. So then, you know, how does the setting create the space? Think of it almost like in a state agent. Like, what's the flow of the room so the child has space to be able to step back and look in and not feel pressured? So, for example, at Leaf Nurseries, you will see a lot of sofas and dens. So the children sometimes sit on the sofa to look over. So they're in that cozy, safe space, sometimes with another child chatting, sometimes with a book, sometimes with a teddy, just sometimes watching. But feeling in and out. And that's very important, that sense of in and out. And the same with dens. We have a lot of dens so that children can crawl in. It's all cozy inside. And they can just have 2 minutes to breathe, you know, to be themselves, not to have to be nice or to talk to someone or to engage in activities, but just to go, whew, just had a long day. I just need a break. And that's very important for two-year-olds who are full of emotions.
Brilliant. Oh, they're great tips, June. Lovely ways to think about it, because it's very easy to get kind of caught up in the superficiality of like a nicely painted door or new windows or whatever. Yeah. But actually, the truth of the matter is it's the sense you get off your child that's the most important thing, and indeed the kind of care and attention of the
staff. Do they know the child? Do they know their names? Do they know their favourite little things? Do they know their idiosyncrasies? You know, do they know which... it's their hand they're trying to write with. Do they know what they call their favorite little toy? Do they know what their favorite books are? If they have that sense of that, then I wouldn't be too happy. You know, yeah. You want them to know the children well. And then therefore, when you're having your conversation at the end of the day, which we call a pedagogical conversation, where they're explaining the because and so, you feel like they've known your child all day and you feel like they've got a sense of them. And they've got a sense of their quirkiness. Every child is quirky in their own way. And that's very joyful for a parent because it feels like that child has had a good day and somebody's got them. You know,
yeah.
We've got them.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it gives a great sense of reassurance. And is there a chance? So when you were talking about the different things that a child does when he or she comes into your nursery, it reminded me when my son started nursery and I really hadn't prepared him enough, I'll be honest. He had Velcro shoes. He had that, honestly, I'm not even sure he did the Velcro himself. I think I mollycoddled him every step of the way because I think I thought there was no way he could know these kind of things, like hanging up his coat, carrying his own book and all that kind of stuff. Now, I know I was wrong. I realized that. And by the time my daughter came around, I wised up a little bit. Can you talk to us a little bit about fundamentals you think parents should have in place before kids go to nursery?
So if you're preparing your child for nursery, then don't worry too much, for one. What staff want to know is the things about your child, the little, you know, the little idiosyncrasies, the little words they use to describe things, particularly if they're coming from a family where your first language is not English. The job of the nursery is to teach them English, and children soon make those distinctions between home is French or home is Italian or home is Urdu and nursery is English. Settling in can be quite tricky on that score, though. So, you know, it's great when we have staff who also speak those languages because it reassures parents more than the children. The second thing is don't worry about food, but be very clear about what's on offer. So decent nurseries have decent chefs who have really carefully planned nutritional sort of diets. So like for us at Leaf Nurseries, we have a chef academy. So the chefs are all trained and we know about portion control and we know about allergies, but we also know about how to build an interesting meal for children so that it attracts them rather than alienates them. So don't worry, just be clear about what's going to happen and what the children eat. And then the other thing is, if you want them to have a sleep and that, two-year-olds will tend to have a sleep. You just have to live with that. But again, like their little ways that they want to sleep. But remember that when children go to sleep in a nursery, there's two staff sitting on the floor with them. So it's like they're never on their own. Anything special. So like little children sometimes go to sleep with their hands over their heads or their hair in their front, or they've got a little comforter or some types. Just all of those things make the settling in better. Be prepared to spend a bit of time settling in. Children want to come to the nursery. They generally love the idea of it, but they don't want to leave you either because they love you. And so they want you to be there too. And we do encourage you to stay. There's a point when you have to go though. And yeah, it's terrible and it feels dramatic. Sometimes for a lot of children, they're like a 2 years old, they're kind of pleased. They kind of get the idea that you'll be back, but they also get the idea that they're going to have fun with their friends. So those kind of things are the things to focus on. Worry not about their coats, their hats. We teach them how to do all of that. Worry not about their shoes, but don't try and put really fancy, awkward shoes on. And when you're sending them in on your clothes, think about the clothes. It's much better if they can learn to pull their pants up and down, because we will toilet train them. There's a big concern in the world at the moment that children aren't toilet trained on time. There's no child that has ever left a leave nursery that hasn't gone to school completely and fully toilet trained, unless they had significant send issues. So, but it does make it easier. I used to say to parents, bring me 10 pairs of pants and we'd have it done in a week. And it's those kind of things that matter. So don't get worked up about complicated things. Just think about the practical things and keep asking questions. What can I do? What can I help? And then ask your little child in the evening as well. Sometimes they'll remember the day, or they'll say, yeah, yeah, it was fun, or I didn't eat anything, or, you know, they'll tell you nothing really. But it's just making sure that it's the basics that are covered. The rest is about having a really nice experience of play, fun, developing their friendships and building their confidence, which is ultimately why you tend to send them to nursery in the first case.
Brilliant. Jude, that's so informative, so helpful for our parents. So now we know, terrible twos, we've got an insight into it. You've helped us a lot about picking nurseries as well. So it's been fantastic talking to you. Thanks a million for joining us on the Parents Show.
Thank you, Lydia. It's a pleasure.
That was June O'Sullivan, CEO of London Early Years Foundation. So we're going to take a little break on the Parents Show on Mix 92.6. We'll be back with more chat in just a few minutes, so stay tuned.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Thanks for staying with us on the Parents Show on Mix 92.6.
I'm Lydia El-Khoury, and today I'm delighted to be joined by women's fitness coach and fitness trainer, Kim Hember, who's here in the studio with me now. Kim, how are you?
Hello, Lydia. I'm very well, thank you.
It's lovely to have your smiling face in the studio to brighten the day up. So for those of our listeners who haven't heard about you locally, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, your family, all that stuff.
Okay, I was born and brought up here in St Albans, and I still live locally. I've got two grown-up children now, Neo, who's 23, and James, who's 18. And I coach locally down at Thrive Fitness Coaching in Highfield Park, and also online with a new online coaching fitness and nutrition service.
Brilliant. So, Kim, I know you. It's full disclosure. I go to Thrive, so that's how I know you and know what a positive and lovely coach you are.
You're very kind.
Now, what I want to know is, if I told you when you were 40 or maybe 50 that you would end up being a fitness coach, what would you have said to me?
I would have laughed and said, absolutely no chance. I was 5 stone overweight at 50. I was completely sedentary. I didn't do any exercise at all. I'd been struggling with my weight for years. And I decided that exercise just wasn't my thing. I honestly thought midlife was about slowing down, gaining weight, feeling less like me. And I never imagined I'd turn things around myself, let alone be helping other women to turn their lives around too. But as I changed my diet and took up strength training in my 50s, everything changed. I didn't just lose weight. I gained confidence. I gained energy and a whole outlook, a whole new outlook on what was possible in life. And I realised that midlife isn't the beginning, not the beginning of the end. It can be the start of something incredible.
That's amazing to hear. And actually, anybody who's listening in, you have to go on social media while you listen to this because you have to see Kim and how fit and healthy and radiant you are. So, I mean, it's such a lovely story. And all us moms, and I'm being a bit prejudiced now, this episode might just be for the moms. Although dads can do it too. But I think as moms, it's easy to let the weight pile on. It's easy to get cozy on the sofa and have the evening snacks and all that kind of stuff, isn't it?
Yes, but it is never too late, never too late to make a change and completely transform your life, your fitness, your outlook.
Brilliant. Now, tell us, what was your light bulb moment? What did it for you, Kim?
It was my 50th birthday in 2020. I'd realised that I was getting dangerously unhealthy. My weight was increasing. My ability to walk without having to stop and rest was decreasing. I was struggling to reach my feet to put my socks on. And we'd been in and out of lockdown all that year.
Okay.
And I'd seen how dangerous being as overweight as I was could be. And I was just fearful of what the rest of my life might look like if I didn't take some action.
Yeah.
I knew I had to do something. And I knew it couldn't be my old fad style dieting, lose a bit of weight, put it all back on again. And so I did a complete overhaul of my diet, learned a completely different way of eating and started strength training.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Was it hard?
Yes, it was. It was hard because I was learning as I went and I was trying to research, and it was hard because other people's ideas and how they see you takes a little bit of time to change as well. And so people actually find it quite difficult when you start to change completely. So yes, I found it quite hard at the time.
Yeah, on lots of levels. I mean, it's hard enough to get the stamina and determination yourself, never mind having to deal with other people's perceptions of you. But I can totally relate to what you're saying, because people are very quick to comment, aren't
they?
Yes,
they are.
When you change in any way. So would you share some of what you've learned along the way, Kim, with us? Because I'm sure mums who are listening in will just be going, okay, what's the silver bullet?
what I've learned along the way, I mean, there's so many things that I've learned.
Yeah, tell us.
First of all, that you have to find an enjoyable, sustainable way of eating to lose weight and keep it off. I mean, I've lost weight so many times and put it back on. You really have to enjoy what you're doing. You have to nourish your body. And you have to keep hunger at bay. It's absolutely key.
You have to keep hunger at bay. That's excellent. Mm. That's great advice.
I also learned strength training is non-negotiable if you're losing weight. I mean, women our age are already losing muscle. It's really important that we work to preserve the muscle so that what we lose is body fat, not muscle. So, you know, we're losing muscle at an alarming rate. Women lose 30% of their strength between 50 and 70 years old.
Seriously.
Wow. And so, you know, we really have to work to preserve it. It's really important for the rest of our lives.
Do you make that lovely and clear? So strength training, non-negotiable.
Non-negotiable. I learned that it's never too late to change. You know, I was 50. I was, you know, I knew I had to do something, but I was still wondering if I could, you know, whether I could actually make it happen. But what I learned was you can always, always do something different, and you can always improve, you know, where you are and where you're going to be.
Brilliant. That's, I mean, you can always improve where you are and where you're going to be. I mean, I think the optimism that you inject into the process is a little bit infectious. And I think that's what people need. They need, you know, they need to know there's hope that you can be different.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you can make changes. And one of the things that really helps with that, so something else I learned, you need to surround yourself with people who share your goals, people who encourage you, support you, celebrate your successes. The environment around you absolutely shapes your thoughts and your success. So it's really important to have a good group around you.
And a nice kind of cohort of like-minded people.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
That's great. And listen, what advice would you generally give your clients about diet and fitness?
I think the main thing is ditch the fads and focus on what actually works. So prioritise protein, prioritise strength training, and eating whole kind of nourishing foods. You need to make every calorie count. Choose high quality food, plenty of protein, plenty of vegetables, and reduce the ultra processed stuff. Don't think about just what to cut out. Focus on what you need to add in. So I always say to people, more protein, more plants, more movement, more strength.
Yeah, I know. I think you should get a t-shirt with more protein made on it. I think that's,
that's my mantra. It is my mantra, and I'm sure I'll mention it again.
But you know, like when you're talking about more protein, I know people think they know what protein is, but give us some examples of good protein.
Of good proteins, right. Any kind of lean meat, fish, things like cottage cheese, edamame beans are absolutely fantastic. Any kind of bean, in fact. Those are really good ones. Eggs are also good, but not as high in protein as the ones I've already mentioned.
And you love a high-protein yogurt, don't you?
Oh, I do, actually, yes. So high-protein kefir. How could I forget? Yes, one of my staples. So that's breakfast for me. That's also dessert in the evenings because it's wonderful with some berries. You know, it's a little bit of a sweet treat at the end of the day.
See, it's not all about punishment, is it?
Not at all. Not at all. It wouldn't work if it was.
Brilliant. Listen, talk to us about your energy levels as you went along the journey. How did they change? And I have to say, like, as a mom, I don't know, I feel permanently exhausted. And it's what I hear a lot of other moms saying as well.
Mm. Yes, and I was the same. I mean, before I started, I was exhausted all the time. I absolutely know the feeling. It's hard when you're constantly on duty, when you're constantly taking care of everyone else's needs. I found that my energy increased as soon as I started improving my diet. The exercise helps as well, of course. You know, you get the endorphins, you get you feel much better, much more positive. And just going even for a short walk, you know, it can really boost your energy levels. So the other thing with changing my diet is I found that the sugars and the ultra-processed foods I was eating before, when I cut those down, I didn't get the same kind of sugar spikes and slumps and energy spikes and slumps that go alongside that. You know, and protein, again, more protein is really good for controlling your blood sugar and stops those slumps and spikes as well.
So you get more energy from not eating sugar, because I think it's a bit of an urban myth, isn't it? Like, have a bar of chocolate and you'll get more energy.
Mm. I think everyone responds differently to sugar. Some people, it's more extreme than others, but your blood sugar is going to go up and it is going to dip again. And when it dips, your energy will slump. So, you know, yes, sugar will always affect it.
Yeah. Bad news for everybody out there. All those chocolate lovers.
I also found my energy levels were much better once I started getting out more, being outside. Early morning sunshine particularly good, helps you sleep. And obviously sleep really important for, increasing your energy levels too.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It's crucial, isn't it, for mental health, having a good night's sleep.
Mm, absolutely. Yeah. The more you do, the better your sleep.
That's it. And anything else about energy levels that you... Any thoughts you have about that to share with our parents?
No, I mean, I'm going to come back to protein again, yeah. You know, adequate protein. So, you know, we need it for energy. People think of carbohydrates and not a protein, but it's absolutely key.
And, you know, it's funny because we hear these things and we've all heard these things. And I've heard that about protein. But then, I don't know, you got through to me at a certain point when I had heard it, but it actually went through for once. And when you were talking about the yogurts, because there's kefir yogurts, mm-hmm. Yeah, that actually have 30 grams of protein in them. And you make it sound so simple. You're just like kind of go, well, eat that because then you won't be hungry because you shouldn't be hungry. And I was thinking, oh, but I thought diets were about like kind of being hungry and just knowing that you've got to put up and get through it.
And that's what I used to think as well. Yeah, which is why they don't work.
Yeah.
Because you deprive yourself and then a bit later in the day, you're starving hungry and then you eat a biscuit and then it kind of, goes downhill from there. And then people have written off the day and then the whole week and the whole month and the rest of the year.
Yeah. So it's protein all the way. And it's, but the yogurts are a great tip because you can, like you said, have one for breakfast, have one before you go to bed as your treat, and you just won't be hungry.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I've had a client recently who's actually said to me they ate 30 grams of protein in their yogurt for breakfast and they weren't hungry at lunchtime. So they had to miss their lunch.
There you go. Well, there you go. But so the other thing I wanted to ask you about is myths. Like, do you come across myths that us moms have that are being passed around about fitness and dieting and all the kind of stuff? What do you hear, and can you help bust them for us?
I think we've just covered some of it. One of the biggest myths is that to lose weight, you just need to eat less and do more cardio. And it's one of the biggest mistakes I hear all the time. I mean, obviously nutrition matters, but eating too little food and endless cardio, it just makes you tired, hungry, frustrated, and it's just not sustainable. It's just what we were saying. It's not about just eating less. The real key is eating protein, strength training. That's how you lose fat, not muscle. And it's, you know, you actually feel good in the process because you're not hungry.
Yeah. Brilliant. And I think the other thing is people think strength training is going to just make them big.
Ah, yes. Yeah, lifting weights will make me bulky. Yes, second myth. It drives me mad, this one, because women are not going to get bulky. We just don't have the testosterone to build that kind of muscle. And we should be fighting. We're losing muscle at such a rate that we should be fighting to keep every ounce that we can. And so, no, it's not a founded fear. Women need to work, keep their muscle, avoid frailty, avoid not being able to get out of a chair when they're older.
Yeah.
Muscle is your independence in old age.
That's a brilliant thing to tell people. Muscle is your independence in old age. That's brilliant, Kim. And any other urban myths that we're all falling into the trap of?
Well, we touched on this one earlier as well. It's too late for me. That's a bit of an urban myth. We hear it from women, or I hear it from women all the time. But it's never too late. You know, I didn't start till I was 50, and at 54, I'm fitter, stronger, healthier than I've ever been in my life. And I coach lots of lovely women like you, Lydia, who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s. Many of them are now fitter, stronger, healthier, more confident than they've ever been in their lives too. So it's never too late.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Lovely, lovely message, Kim. Now, tell us about Thrive. You mentioned it right at the beginning. So you're down in Highfield Park. And
we are. Six mornings a week.
Six mornings a week. Tell everybody when you start, Kim.
Oh, 6 in the morning. So sessions at 6, 7 and 8 in the morning. And then that's Monday to Friday. And then 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning. And we've got a team of expert coaches. We specialise in strength training for perimenopausal, menopausal women. And we're just a wonderful community. It's all like-minded ladies. They all encourage each other, support each other, cheer each other on. Everyone's really friendly and welcoming. We've got people, obviously, who've just started with us. We've got people who've been with us for more than 10 years.
Wow.
And it's fun. It's, you know, you work hard, but it's good fun. There's certainly no shouting or boot camp-like activities going on. It's, you know, good fun, solid strength training, bit of cardio. And yeah, I absolutely love working there and doing what I do.
Brilliant. That's lovely. So if moms are listening in, Kim, and they want to know your 3 top tips for well-being, now, give us your all. What would you suggest?
Number one,
yeah,
you've got to make time for yourself and your health. You know, busy moms, it's easy to put yourself last. But if you don't take care of yourself, you end up running on empty. You can't take care of everyone else. So that's top tip. You've got to cut some time out for yourself and look after your health for the future. Number 2, eat more protein.
Going to get you a t-shirt.
You knew that was coming, didn't you? It's a midlife superpower. So many women under-eat protein. They just don't realize they're not eating enough. But it helps with preserving muscle. It helps with fat loss. It helps with energy. We've already mentioned it helps with keeping hunger at bay. Women should aim for a minimum of 30 grams a meal.
A meal. Oh,
a meal. And a minimum of 100 grams a day.
Okie doke.
And that's a starting point. once people have got used to that level, because a lot of women will find that a quite surprising level because they tend to eat around 50 to 60 grams a day. But once they're at that level, the ideal then is to aim for a gram for every pound of your ideal body weight. To optimize, you know, your strength, your energy, and keep you well, help you age well. Tip three, strength train. Yeah. your future self will thank you for it. It's an absolute game changer. Yeah. It's preserving muscle, it's preserving bone, stopping you becoming frail, stopping you falling, yeah, making sure you can still get out of a chair, be independent as you grow older.
Yeah.
It's just so important.
It really is. And the thing is, I'm glad the word is out there a bit about strength training around menopause, because it is. People know. There's another thing actually getting out there and doing it. But if these people, I think it's accepted that it's essential. It's really necessary.
As our estrogen drops, you know, that is the hormone that we have, the equivalent to the testosterone in men. It helps build our muscles. And as it drops away, you know, our muscles are just declining. And we have to do something to not only stop that, but if possible, reverse it.
Yeah.
And keep ourselves fit and healthy.
And if you're a runner and you run kind of 10Ks all the time, you still need strength training, don't you?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I mean, that's fabulous for cardio, but you need proper muscle building. You need to stimulate, different muscles as well. You know, you need to use the muscles throughout your body. And functional moves, you know, like getting up and down from a chair, you know, squatting or lunging, which is up and down stairs. So, yes, it's really important to strength train as well.
Yeah. And the thing is, I think everybody knows the exercises you need and to do them. We just never do them. This is the thing.
Sure, we don't.
That's why you need a group of supportive women to, you know, to encourage and help you, you know, make it something you want to do. Yeah. I mean, our ladies love coming along and doing this each day. Yeah. We're a thriving, excuse the pun, thriving community. And the community goes beyond just exercising in the park. We do holidays as well, so skiing and winter sun and weekends away, you know, and other social events. So it's a wonderful community.
Yeah, it's lovely to do that. And the thing is, we all choose the path of least resistance, don't we? When it comes to exercise, like nobody wants to do a burpee. Nobody wants to do lunges. Nobody wants to do kind of star jumps or squats. But they're so important for your mobility. So
absolutely. Yeah. And they always say exercise you like to do the least is the one you should do the most.
Yeah. I know. Thanks for the reminder, Kim. But it's brilliant and great for that reminder. So if anybody's listening in and that resonates with them and they think, yeah, Thrive sounds great, I want to do that, how do they get in touch?
Via our website. That's probably a good place to start, or look us up on Facebook or on Instagram. So yeah, Thrive St Albans on Instagram, Thrive Fitness Coaching on our website.
Brilliant. So, and obviously, you know, there are lots of other services available out there and you should choose the one that suits you the best. But it's just, your message is so clear, Kim, and it's so helpful to moms. Put yourself first, get the protein, get strength training.
Absolutely.
I wish our listeners could see our faces nodding and nodding in approval.
I am, yeah. And then, you know, live a wonderful, healthy second half of your life. It's so important to be well.
Brilliant. Kim, thanks a million for joining us on The Parents Show.
Thank you.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.